Total Rock presents a Total Rockumentary, The Brutal Truth, Alice Cooper, in his own words. When Marilyn Manson was still a distant gleam in Brian Warner's nightmares, before Kiss emerged as Emperor Ming's shock troops, while Slipknot weren't even warm in the womb, let alone the hottest band on the scene, Alice Cooper was already a household name. But who is Alice Cooper? Where does he come from? Our story begins in the Motor City of Detroit with one Vincent Damon Furnier.
I was born February 4th, 1948 in Detroit, Michigan, the murder capital of the world, which may have had something to do with my career. I'm not sure. But it's also the rock and roll capital of the world. If you want a good rock and roll audience anywhere in the world, you come to Detroit. And if it's not loud enough, they'll boo you off the stage. If it's not aggressive enough, they'll boo you off the stage. That had something to do with my career as far as my aggressiveness on stage. I think it has a lot to do with the Motor City. Everything was rough, tough, black leather jackets. And you had to be on your toes. You know, every street had its own gangs. We lived on it's funny because we weren't Polish, but every street there was a different ethnic. There was a Polish street, there was an Italian street, there was a Czech street, there was a, you know, and we'd get up in the morning and play baseball and say, who are we playing today? We're playing the Italians today. Oh, cool. You know, and if you were on your own street, you were fine. Or if you were with the Italians, you were fine because the Italians and us got along. But I mean, there were certain streets you didn't go down without your buddies.
His background might surprise you. He's not the son of Satan, nor the spawn of Hades. In fact, his dad was a used car salesman who went on to become a preacher.
My dad was probably had the most he had the most wrong job for him in all of the world. He was a used car salesman. He was an honest used car salesman in Detroit, working for guys that were absolutely criminals. You know, they turn all the odometers back, and my dad could not lie. He could not. He ended up being a pastor, of course. And, you know, he wanted to be one of the guys, but he could not sell a car to somebody. And by the time they were driving off, he'd run them down and say, no, we turned the odometer back. You know, we fixed this. This, half of this car's Bondo, you know. And they would bring the car back, and these gangsters would say, Mick, you're just not a car salesman. You're too honest to be a car salesman. So we did it very badly. We were very poor as kids. My dad just couldn't be dishonest, and I loved that about him. Still do. Very all-American, very Midwest, all-American, family-oriented, church on Sunday. I couldn't be more all-American than our family.
I love General Patton in World War II. My pocket fisherman and my crazy glue. I love the team and Wally too.
My dad was a very funny man. He was a cut-up. He was a class clown himself. So, I mean, that came easily to me. My dad was one of the funniest people I'd ever met in my life. He had a joke for everything. It was hard for him to preach sometimes because he'd get in the middle of a sermon and go, oh, by the way. So, and he was a sharp dresser. My dad was taught me how to dress. He was like, you know, taught me how to tie a Windsor knot, you know, tight one, you know, like a Reservoir Dogs. And, you know, he says, you never wear a baggy suit. You wear an Italian cut suit, slim, you know. I thought, and every time I saw my dad, he looked like he was on the cover of GQ magazine. He was so hip.
So, just how did Vincent Furnier of Nowhere, Detroit, get into music and start the long ascent or descent, depending upon your viewpoint, towards Cooper Country?
I always loved music. From being from Detroit, I was at the perfect age. When Elvis came out, I was six. 7 years old. Saw Elvis on the Ed Sullivan Show. And just, I was a natural mimic. I went and combed my hair immediately like Elvis and stood in front of the TV with my lip up like that. And my hair, you know. And my parents thought that was cute. And then when I was 15, then I saw the Beatles. I was at the perfect age for the Beatles. And I went, oh, man, that changes everything, you know. And then I saw the Stones. When my parents hated the Beatles until they saw the Stones. When they saw the Stones, suddenly the Beatles were okay, you know. And they said, well, they wear suits and their hair is kind of tidy. It's not that bad, but look at these Stones. I was already thinking, how can I make the Stones look like choir boys? You know, it was already brewing. I was already inventing Alice in my head up here, you know.
Pleased to meet you. Hope you guessed my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game. Stuck around St. Petersburg when I saw it was a time for a change. Killed the Tsar and his ministers, Anastasia screamed in vain. I rode a tank, held a generous rank, when the blitzkrieg raged and the bodies stank. Pleased to meet you, hope you guess my name. Oh yeah, I was puzzling you with the nature of my game. Oh yeah.
Got in a band when we were 15 in high school. You know, at that time, see, you have to remember in America, at that time, there were no such thing as bands. If you were in a band, you were in a surf band. You played Wipeout and you played Dick Dale stuff. That was all there was. Nobody sang and played at the same time. That was really unheard of until we saw the Beatles. That is so different.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night. I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright.
So we had a choice at that time in our life where the next summer we were either going to go to work at Safeway or the car wash. Now we had a new option. We could put a band together. And none of us knowing anything about music, we would just start from scratch, learn how to play, listen to the Beatles, learn how to play note for note, and play parties for $20 a piece. That seemed like the best thing to do. And that's how it started. Wait, my sister is the only person who will give me an honest answer about my music. My sister is fiercely independent. And yeah, I'll go in and I'll get an album done, or maybe I'll write some songs. I don't take it to Shep. I don't take it to Brian Nelson. I don't take it to all these people that work for me. I take it to Nikki. And I said, Nikki, what do you think about this? She'll listen to it. She'll go, well, you can do better than that. You know, or she'll say, love that. I think that's great. And, or she'll say, you did that already. And I go, when? And she'll tell me when. Okay, great. She gives me the dead honest answer without any consequences at all. The funny thing about my sister was that she was straight A's. She got all the grades. Did you ever see a movie called Ferris Bueller's Day Off? Okay. My sister, I was Ferris Bueller. My sister was the sister that just couldn't believe I got away with everything. When I saw that movie, I said, this is my life. I was Ferris Bueller. I ran my school. I passed. I got away with everything. And my sister with straight A's would sit there and go, I don't believe he gets away with this.
And if you ever doubted that being the local rock star could get you the girls, then Alice can put you very straight on that score, because he was scoring big time.
We were the earwigs. We were the earwigs. An earwig is a bug about this big that literally can crawl in your ear and lay eggs. And the eggs hatch and literally drive you insane. We were, you know, of course, we were a parody of the Beatles. We did a parody of the Beatles. And we all started out as a joke. And we hired girls to scream for us. And we had Beatle wigs on and the whole thing. And it was funny. We did it as a talent show. And we got the bug immediately. This is, you know, if we just learned three songs, we could actually play. And so we learned the three songs. and we learned screenwriting. And pretty soon we had 12 songs we could play. So we'd go to a party and play 12 songs three times, and nobody minded. And, we became actually a pretty decent band in high school. Then we became the Spiders because we didn't get cooler. By the time I was a junior in high school, we were headlining the top club in Phoenix. We actually had a local record out called Don't Blow Your Mind that was number two on the charts, only bested by Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. How cool is it to go to school and your record is playing on the radio next to the Beatles and the Stones and the Beach Boys, and you're number two on the local charts? Wow. You think we had any problem with girls? No.
You're listening to a total rockumentary, The Brutal Truth, Alice Cooper, in his own words.
I played harmonica because I had to learn certain Beatles songs. And later on, that really paid off because we ended up then getting a little more experimental with Yardbirds. And Keith Relf could play harmonica. And so I really buckled down and learned how to play everything that he played. And then went on later on in the career, before we actually started really doing our own stuff, and we would go to a place and do Paul Butterfield. And I would learn Paul Butterfield harmonica. But it came very natural to me. I don't know why, but I could play blues harp. I play guitar. I don't play any piano, but I can play guitar. But I could never pick up my guitar players. I always surrounded myself with the best guitar players. Because I've always thought that music goes in tangents, but it always comes back to garage rock. Who's the best garage band in the world? The Rolling Stones. Guns N' Roses. Aerosmith. Hopefully Us. Led Zeppelin. These are great garage bands. Five guys, two guitars, bass, drums, and a lead singer is where it always comes back to. The music will always go in tangents and come right back to the core of rock and roll. So, I learned how to play guitar, but I always surrounded myself with really good guitarists.
But just who were his vocal inspirations?
Keith Relf. I didn't really have a choice. I didn't have a lot of range in my voice till later. I developed the Alice voice later. Actually, we had three or four different personalities for Alice. He was sort of like Sybil, He had all these, he could have the real creepy voice, or he could have the power voice, or he could have the whining voice. I could actually do a pop voice very well, too. But the one people mostly knew was the growl kind of, very aggressive Alice voice. School's out, elected.
Right from the start, Alice knew that he wanted to turn the dark side into a theatrically villainous presentation. But it was meeting Frank Zappa in 1969 that finally put everything into a naturally warped perspective.
We always dressed in black. We were the Spiders, so we were always a certain amount of dark. We always had a little dark side, even though we were very pop. When it came time to actually develop, we were a really good psychedelic band when we met Frank Zappa. And we were actually called the Nazz.
When I pray in my final arms, all the people
people in Los Angeles knew us because we played a lot of local gigs there. There were 20,000 bands trying to play in 8 places. And so you would go on at 4 in the morning just trying to get noticed as the Nazz. We realized this was not working. The Nazz was just, nobody cared. And I said, guys, we have one more shot. And that is to, let's go for what we do best. We are naturally weird. Let's take it and let's develop it. I said, look at all the heroes. Look at all the rock heroes. Look at the Beatles. Look at the Stones. Look at all these guys. Where are the villains? I said, let's invent the villain. Let's be Captain Hook. Let's be Zorro. Let's be Batman. And let's be Dracula, all rolled up into one. And that's when I developed the Alice character.
Our hero was still going under the name on his birth certificate, but all that was about to change, thanks to a long-dead witch. Well, that's the legend. The truth, however, is slightly different. There was no witch called Alice Cooper, only the weird imagination of Vincent Damon Furnier.
The witch was one of those things that just got blown way out of proportion. We said, I was sitting there, I can tell you exactly when it happened. We were sitting at a front, there was this girl band called the Weeds Vitals that were the worst band I'd ever heard in my life. But they would feed us. So we'd go to their house and we'd sit around talking and I said, we've got to have a name that, and you know, we all loved Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. We loved that movie. I said, think Betty Davis. Remember her look in that? She's really old, but she's trying to be a little girl. And she's got, her makeup is really bad. It's not put on correctly at all. It's kind of smeared. And what is scary about her? That makeup is really scary. And that little frilly thing. I said, what if we looked like that? I said, and what if we had a name like, and I could have said Mary Anderson. I could have said Betty Thompson. I said, what if it was like Alice Cooper? I pictured a little girl, a sweet little girl with her hand behind her back, and behind her back she had a switchblade. You know, I said, that's it. I said, that's much scarier than calling ourselves, you know, Scab or Death Warmed Over or whatever that people would expect. I said, they're expecting that, but they're not expecting Alice Cooper. I said, that's good. I'll be Alice. The band's name was Alice Cooper. I was Vince. The audience just gave me the name. So I ended up with the name. And then I went and got my name changed legally to Alice Cooper. By now, we'd been thrown out of Los Angeles. And we said, okay, we're going to go, the first place we go and get a standing ovation, that's where we're going to go live. We played everywhere, you know. And finally we got to Detroit. We got into a big pop festival with Iggy, MC5, 300,000 Detroit kids going, who the hell is Alice Cooper? And we went up there and just scared the hell out of them. And they immediately said, yes! I mean, they raved. The next thing, we were the biggest act in Detroit. We were opening for The Who, and we were opening for every act that came into Detroit. And we were getting bigger reactions than some of these bands that were coming in. Not bigger than The Who, they were The Who. I mean, you know, they were the best. But certainly, you know, when Savoy Brown would come in, and we'd open for them, we'd blow them off the stage. They were better musicians than us, but we were certainly more exciting.
Alice Cooper, the band, were to make the grade from cult local heroes to the national and international stage in 1971 with the hit single I'm 18, which was that pain to teenage angst, anger, and attitude.
We met Bob Ezrin. He was our George Martin. And he came in and he said, look, stop everything. Here's my take on Alice Cooper. Everybody loves you, but there's no musical handle. In other words, you hear a Doors record, and you know it's a Doors record. You hear a Love record, and you know it's Arthur Lee in Love. You hear a Beatles record, you hear a Stones record. You guys haven't got a signature. So for 6 months, all we did was we went to the barn in the back, and we had a big farm in Detroit. and we rehearsed 10 hours a day. 10 hours a day. On the weekends, we'd go play and make enough money to live. He worked us to death, and the album that came out of that was Love It to Death. It was the first Alice Cooper album. Pretty's for You and Easy Action were called Alice Cooper out, but they really weren't. The first Alice album was Love It to Death, our third album. That was had a signature. It had 18, it had Dwight Fry, it had Isn't My Body, Sunrise, and it all sounded like it all fit together. And it had this sort of dark shadow over it.
To a total rockumentary, The Brutal Truth, Alice Cooper, in his own words.
So the first time we heard 18 on CKLW, it was a pick hit. Unbelievable. That means people in Ohio are hearing this, in Michigan, and Detroit, and Cleveland, and all over. And we went, just the fact that they're putting it on the pick hit is unbelievable. Next thing we know, most requested. Wow, that is, we lucked out on that one. You know. Next thing we know, it's number one. And that's, and CKLW at that time was probably the most powerful station in America. So we had a number one. And everybody in the country took notice and said, wait a minute. This is that band that scares everybody to death. They have a number one record. This is something to notice now. This is a trend. Now we've got something.
And the stage show was well developed by then.
Well, we did a full out thing. They were hanging me. We had an electric chair at that point. You couldn't afford the gallows, it was too expensive. But we did build our own props. We had feather pillows on stage with strobe lights, and it looked like, you know, like a psychedelic snowstorm up there. Anything, see, at that time, everything we built everything ourselves. We had to build our own props. We just couldn't afford to have them made. That made it even more guerrilla theater, though. You know, it made it even scarier that this whole thing was not expensive looking, it was just scary, you know. And now they've given us a hit record. That was like putting like gasoline on the fire. So, well, you know.
Good things inevitably come crashing down, and in 1974, the Alice Cooper Band fell apart. Most people believe that the singer fired the other four guys, but Alice himself has a different viewpoint on those times.
No, it wasn't that at all, and I always laugh at that. That I always, when people say you fired the band, I was one-fifth of the band. I had no power. I was the lead singer. We split everything five ways. We had two major gold albums, School's Out, Billion Dollar Babies, both number one, and Muscle of Love, which was number three in a row. And then the band says, okay, now we don't want to have to do the theater anymore. We don't want to spend all that money on the production. We want to wear Levi's on stage. We want to wear t-shirts. And I went, you must be kidding. I said, I'm just the opposite. I want to take it to the next level. I want to do Welcome to My Nightmare. I want to take it to the level nobody's ever seen this. So we'll make Billion Dollar Baby show, which was a huge show, look like kindergarten. Because we have the means to do it now. Just didn't want to do that. They all wanted to make their own private albums. You know, it was like the curse of all of a sudden them believing their hype. And I didn't believe that. I said, guys, we make our own hype. You have to understand. They want to be like us now. We won. We won the fight. You know? Let's enjoy it. Now there's a David Bowie in England that's following in our footprint. Now there's this guy and this guy and this guy. They're all coming through the door, this theatrical door. We opened it up. So let's not go backwards now. You know, could not convince them. So it was not a matter of an argument. It wasn't a matter of anybody leaving in a huff. I just said, guys, I can't do it. I will not go up there and just be a lead singer. So we won the war. Now I want to reap the benefits of it. And I think at that time, 1974, I had about $400,000 cash. And that was a lot of money at the time. Shep, my manager, had about that. And we said, let's going to put all of our money together. We're going to do Welcome to My Nightmare. Roll the dice. If it works, it's going to be big. If it flops, we're out. We lose. Big roll of the dice. And so we did it. And it cost a ton of money, that show did. And production, 3 months of production, rehearsal. But it played every night for 2 years to sold out all over the world. And it worked. And it broke everything open.
Welcome to my breakdown. I hope I didn't scare you. That's just the way we are when we come down. We sweat and laugh and scream here, 'cause life is just a dream here. You know inside you feel right at home here. You're welcome.
The band ended up putting on the chrome pants again and calling themselves the Billion Dollar Babies. And I'm going, jeez, guys, what were you thinking? By this time, I had a band that would just blow anybody off the stage. I had Dick Wagner and Steve Hunter and Prakash John and people like that in my band. I mean, these guys were untouchable. And I wasn't going to go backwards. You know, I said, you guys made your bed. We're still all friends. You know, in fact, we just played together. The original band got together at Cooperstown, my restaurant, and we did an hour together, and it was great. So there's no bad feelings. It's just that, you know, going back and reforming, maybe when we're 60, we'll do that. But right now, I'm trying to compete with Limp Bizkit and Korn. That's why, you know, Brutal Planet is very aggressive. I'm not trying to go backwards. I'm trying to go forward.
Welcome to my breakdown.
But right now, Alice's priority is his current album, Brutal Planet, a concept album based on the true horror of real-life tragedy.
It started out with the idea of, I thought, what scares me? I'm going to write something. People expect it to be scary because I don't mind being the Stephen King of rock and roll. I don't mind writing things like The Last Temptation and albums that got a definite darkness to it, but a morality to it. I wanted to have a morality to it. And I thought, what scares me? And I realized that fiction didn't scare me. Nothing fictional scared me. And what really scared me was CNN. I'd sit there and I'd watch, and I'm watching that. And there's this guy literally walking through this town that had just been ravaged. Smoke is still coming off the ground. It looks like a movie set. He's got a hefty bag or something, and he's picking up this spinal cord with ribs on it. He says, this is my cousin. He picks up a skull. That's my aunt. He's collecting his family after this army came through. And I went, I said, this is hell. This is hell on earth. And this didn't happen 50 years. This is yesterday. in Kosovo. And I wrote Pick Up the Bones right there. I said, this is scary. This is scarier than Dwight Fry. It's scarier than anything I've ever written because it's real. Then Columbine happens, and I went, what is more horrific than two kids that are not on drugs? They don't come from a bad home. It's not the movies. It's not the games they play. It's not any of the stuff. They're just pure evil. These kids are pure evil. I wrote Wicked Young Man that was about a guy that is pure evil. Hitler was pure evil. Charles Manson, pure evil. Psychopathic. Sociopathic. People that have no conscience about killing. To me, that's pure evil. I said, this is all starting to make sense. And I said, okay, now I'm going to project this into a place. Where would Alice project this to? Dante's Inferno. Well, I can't call it that. Brutal Planet. Years from now, what if all of this is just the beginning? 50 years from now, technology fails. Where are we? We're all just survivors now. We're on Brutal Planet. And that's what wrote it. And I started writing the idea behind all of this, you know. And once you write it, then it basically it's a blueprint for the stage. You know, well, what is the stage going to look like? Well, it's got to look like it's just been nuked. Post-nuclear Cleveland. And what does Alice look like? Well, he's got to be this horrendous half samurai, half cannibal, half whatever he is, leader of these, you know, guys. And he's perfect. I know just how to make him look on the chopsticks, you know, and the samurai sword and, you know, and he's got a hunting knife on the back of his boot, you know, and it's just one of those survivalist kind of really scary characters.
Alice Cooper's come a long way since the days of Vincent Furnier, a true giant of rock. He's followed the truism that you shouldn't dream it, just be it. And be sure of one thing, this is one legend looking to the future rather than living in the past. Here's to the next 30 years. This has been a total rockumentary. The brutal truth. Alice Cooper in his own words.